This is Bible School Day 5, Class 2, Brother Mark Vincent, speaking for the week on the enigma of Ecclesiastes, and today's study is life and how to live it. Brother Mark.
Well, good morning, everybody. I stayed up very late last night looking for some happy verses in Ecclesiastes. So it's going to be a short talk this morning. Before we get onto the happy stuff, and actually there is some, let's be sad for a little bit more first, just to remind ourselves what it's been like. I want to talk a little bit about what Solomon does in chapter 1. Chapter 1 and chapter 2. So the preacher goes on this great experiment, doesn't he, looking at all the things that he can find under the sun. This is 1 and verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. And what you've got in that little passage from verse 12 right down to the end of the chapter, you've got all these references to all. He looks at all the things, you know, all the various domains of men and his endeavors, and he concludes that all of them are vanity and vexation of spirit. And then what he does in chapter 2 is he goes on to look, to indulge himself in various things in which human beings like to indulge, whether they're the arts and culture, you know, whether it's highbrow things like, you know, expensive and refined bottles of wine, you know, developing his palate in sophisticated ways that most of us couldn't begin to, determine, perhaps. Well, maybe many of you can. I'm not much good with wine. He goes into music. He goes into comedy. He goes into the collection of material things. He becomes a horticulturalist. He develops gardens and vineyards. Every sphere of human endeavor, he investigates it and does it to the max to see that, you know, if only he pursues this thing to its end, if that will bring the satisfaction, the fulfillment, that missing thing that human beings are seeking. Verse 1 of chapter 2, I said in my heart, go to now, I will prove thee with mirth, therefore enjoy pleasure. And behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of mirth, what doeth it? And you can imagine that, can't you? You can imagine him saying, okay, well, comedy, maybe comedy is the answer. And I don't really listen to or watch comedy particularly, but you know, you can imagine him assembling, you know, if he were doing it today, summoning the best comedians from around the world and getting them to come. You know, every night a different comedian comes to the palace and performs, and ha 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 ha, it's really funny, and ha ha ha, it's suddenly the joke's on him, isn't it? And the laughter is rather empty. You know, you're always looking for the bigger laugh. Maybe the next joke is going to be better than the one that you just had. And in fact, it's the opposite. Each time, the incremental bit of enjoyment is less and less and less until ultimately you start to diminish from the thing that you were involved in, don't you? And it starts to become rather empty. And the laughter is hollow. And the joke is on you. You are the joke, in thinking that was what life was all about. And of course, you know, I mean, we know life isn't all about comedy, don't we? I mean, it's kind of obvious. And yet, somehow, we often live as though it were about these things, not comedy specifically, but these various pursuits that human beings engage in. Verse 3, I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. I made me great works, I builded me houses, I planted me vineyards, I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees, pools of water, got himself servants. So all these things he goes into, you know, the collection of material things, and we say, well, what is Western society about? What is Western society obsessed with nowadays? And it hasn't changed, has it? It's all those things. And if only I had that thing, then I would be truly happy. You know, whatever it is that we're interested in, whether it's cars or homes or wine or whatever, you know, we often live in that way. We fool ourselves, or at least I fool myself, into thinking, you know, if only, you know, this that I have is really good, but if only I had that, then I would really have arrived. Then I would be really happy. That would be the ultimate. And then I'd never want anything else again. Honest. You know, if only I could have that thing, then I'd just be satisfied forever. And of course, you know that that's a complete illusion, don't you? And as soon as you get that thing, then the emptiness kicks back in again with a vengeance, doesn't it? And there's a phenomenon that's, you know, been identified called post-purchase depression. And you get that thing, and then you're empty again, and you're not filled or fulfilled again until you find something else to obsess on, and then you get that thing. And you know, this is the obvious example of material things, but this can be the case in many different avenues of life, can't it? Let's look at what Solomon concluded. Verse 10 of chapter 2. And whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion of all my labor. Then I looked. I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit, and there was no profit under the sun. And we're back where we started again, aren't we? We're back to where we've been all the way through this week. It's a zero-sum game. Brother Ron reminded me of that phrase last night, and that's it, isn't it? That sums it up. All these things that counterbalance one another, the point and counterpoint, so ultimately your net position is zero. Now, Solomon did that experiment of going into all those different avenues and pursuing them to the max. And he's been able to do it better than anyone else who's ever lived because of that, you know, relative position of wealth and abundance and wisdom that he was in at that time. And he could do it better than we ever can because he had so many more resources at his disposal and he was so much more important than we are. You know, this is like Bill Gates, isn't it? Being able to pursue whatever he wants to pursue because he has whatever resources at his disposal. And yet he too will find, as Solomon found, that in any of those things, that is not the answer. That's not the meaning of life, is it? That's not the key to what it's all about. All that is more emptiness. And the fact that Solomon did that experiment and came to that conclusion is so valuable for us because it means that we don't have to. And in a way, it was a waste of Solomon's time, wasn't it? And in a way, it was a gain for us because he saved us some time. And yet, I was reading a book once which pointed out, and it said, the world is full of people performing millions and millions of experiments, just repeating Solomon's experiment again and again and again. And to some extent, every human being who comes onto this stage and walks across it repeats that experiment to some degree, don't they, in some aspect of their lives, and confuses what the real aim of life is with something else that is but a vapor, a shadow that passes away and leaves a net of zero. So the existential point, then, of all of this is a simple one and one that we know well, but one which Solomon reminds us of powerfully. There is nothing under the sun that can truly satisfy us, that can truly bring us the fulfillment, that can fill that empty void that God has built into the heart of man. Because that void and that emptiness can only be filled by Him. He has built that sense of eternity into our heart, that we might seek him. And so the conclusion to that is then, let's not waste our time by being too distracted by all that stuff. Now it's hard, isn't it? It's hard to apply that. We're always getting distracted. You know, there's all these bright, glitzy things, and we're on this path, and there are all those things. That, oh, look over there. That looks really cool. And off we go, you know, wandering off for a while. And then, you know, hopefully we have the wisdom of Solomon to say, yeah, that's not really the way, is it? And then we sort of come faltering back again to the path. This book then helps us to give us that sense of perspective about the vanities of this world and about where the true weight of glory really rests. Now, one of the things that we looked at yesterday for a few moments was Solomon's contention, the preacher's contention, that we're never going to work it all out. We're never going to have all the answers about this life. We're never going to have a set of rules that says, well, I can now proceed through life without any problems or difficulties. You know, that doesn't exist because God has made it so that we cannot find out all the answers. God has made crooked these things so that we can't make them straight. And so that instead we should long for a world in which they will be straight, a world that is a world of righteousness that he will set up. And I'd like us to just follow through that idea a little bit more because it's very, very important. And you know, you might like to make a study of this. It's interesting just to go through the book of Ecclesiastes and just note down everything that it says about God, and about what God has done. And it's a very instructive thing to do. And we'll just take a couple of those passages. And one of them is in chapter 1. And we started to read it, verse 13. And I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. And then notice what he says in the second half of the verse. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. And you notice the point. This sore travail hath God given to the sons of men. This is a God-given vanity, this life in which we find ourselves. God has made the world like this on purpose to exercise us. Now, the purpose of exercise, you know, it's not that sitting there on a treadmill is so fun of itself, is it? You know, the reason we do that is because we think that there are positive benefits that will come from doing so. Like we might live longer or we might be healthier. Now, the tragedy of you know, when we look in the world around us is that there are all these people pedaling and pedaling and pedaling, or jogging and jogging and jogging on their treadmill, and they're not going anywhere. God's meant that they're not going, meant them not to be going anywhere, that it is a zero-sum game. But he's meant for us to look and say, this is a bit stupid, isn't it? Just pedaling and pedaling and pedaling like this. You know, it's like watching a mouse on its wheel, and we look at the mouse there, and we think, what a sorry existence that is for the mouse doing that. And yet we're all doing it to some degree, aren't we? And God has made us do it to exercise us and to make us think there's got to be more to it. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, there is. And that's the rest of the Bible. Isn't it? That's the conclusion of the book. That's why the book is leading us to the answer of what it's all about is to fear God and to keep his commandments. God has given us this sore travail to exercise us. And the language of travail, that sore travail, takes us back to Genesis. And again, it takes us, takes us forward to Romans 8 that we keep mentioning. Let's turn over to chapter 3, because this isn't an idea that's stated just once. This is a chain of references that runs through the book. Chapter 3 and verse 10. I have seen the travail which God hath given to the sons of men to be exercised in it. It's almost verbatim of what we just read, isn't it? Solomon asserting the same point. That God's made us have this futile existence so that we can perceive the contrast with something else and truly value it. Verse 17, this is one that we looked at earlier when we were talking about the subject of death. I said in mine heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked. Verse 18. I said in mine heart concerning the estate of the sons of men, that God might manifest them and that they might see that they themselves are but beasts. God is trying to show us something by putting us in this pointless world. He's trying to make us appreciate his value and the value of his kingdom, which is to come. Chapter 7, we looked at this yesterday from a different angle. Chapter 7 and verse 13, consider the work of God, for who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? God has put this warp into the world that we live in. And there's a similar verse in Habakkuk. We won't turn to it, but in Habakkuk 2, I think it is, where the prophet says, is it not of the Lord that the people weary themselves as fuel for the fire? You know, God's made it like that on purpose. But God has given us the clue, hasn't he, elsewhere in Scripture, by telling us what it is that we should focus on. So how then should we live? Well, we could turn to the rest of the Scriptures for that, and you know, broadly we know what that message is. But it's interesting to consider what there is within the words of the preacher himself that will teach us about that, that will teach us about how we should live. Because there's actually a decent amount of material on that. And there are really two sides of it that I'd like us to look at. One of them is, there are these moments in the book where the preacher, you know, he's describing his observations, isn't he? And he's saying, I tried this and I saw that it was vanity. Then I tried this and I saw that that was vanity too. And we're watching him go about the world and collect those observations and conclusions. But then there are times where he turns to the camera, as it were, and talks directly to you and me. Instead of saying, this, I saw this and that, and he was doing this and she was doing that, he says, and this is what you should do. And those little references sort of punctuate the book. And just sort of, you know, if we're sort of being lulled into a stupor of, yeah, oh yeah, more vanity, more vanity, more vanity, just sort of, here's something now, here's a take-home point for me to think about and to try to put in practice. Because even though this world is all vanity, there are still better and worse ways of living within it. And he points that out to us. And some of those things would sort of apply to everyone, whether or not you are a believer in God or not. They're sort of common sense things. For example, let me give you an example of that. Yield to a ruler, you know, to people in authority. Generally, you know, it's the wiser course, isn't it? To respect authorities rather than try to fight against them. Don't argue with people. Don't curse the king or the rich because they're more powerful than you, and in the end, you might live to regret it. So that's a sort of common sense rule of thumb that would be helpful to us, as it would to an unbeliever too. But there are other ones that are more specifically to do with God. Let me give you some more examples, because we're just gonna during the course of the rest of the time, we're just gonna look at two, turning them up. But this might be worth just sharing some of the others with you. Don't be hasty to anger. Do not ask why the past is better than the present. It's not a wise way to spend your time. Focus on the now and what can be done, and what attitude it's right to have here and now. And that's something, you know, that links to the New Testament, doesn't it? About, you know, while it's still today, while we've got the moment of opportunity, let's take it. Don't let's live in the past. Give yourself to wisdom. Don't worry about what others say. Just get on with it. Get on with trying to do the right thing. Keep the king's word and behave in his presence. Be wise. But the one that we'll look at this point is in chapter 5. So again, it's another good study to, you know, maybe one time when you're doing the readings in Ecclesiastes, you might want to do this. You know, just as you read through the book, just note down all the times where there is this specific advice that's addressed to you, where the specific advice that tells us about a good way of living in this world. Because as I've already said, although it's a vain world, there are still better and worse ways of living within it. And the preacher has some advice for us on that topic. And here's one in chapter 5. Keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God. So you see, this is a thou passage, isn't it? This is where he turns to the camera and addresses us specifically and says, keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not that they do evil. So he's talked about the foot there, and he's talked about the ear, hasn't he? Be more ready to hear. And this fits, doesn't it? So if it's right what he's been saying about, you know, our limits, the way that death limits us, the way that time limits us and controls us, the way that nothing we do in this life has any ultimate profit or anything that goes beyond, then, you know, if we really take that on board, then we realize that we're pretty small, aren't we? We're pretty, you know, we're pretty worm-like in comparison to God. We're small indeed. So why do we have so much to say? You know, why do we think we know so much? And we do, don't we? To some degree or other, we're all full of our own smartness and opinions, aren't we? And the message here is about realizing that gulf and saying, well, perhaps I should be quiet a bit more and just try to learn from what God is doing. People say, I like to think that, don't they? And then, you know, people have lots of theories about lots of things. And, you know, that's fine to a certain degree. You know, God's given us brains to think and to have opinions. So that's absolutely fine. But, you know, sometimes when people say, I like to think that, it's actually more than that, isn't it? It's like, and you ought to think that too. This is how it is because I've thought it. Clearly that's not the case. Let's see what he goes on to say, verse 2. Be not rash with thy mouth. Here's another body part. So we've had the foot, the ears, the mouth. And let not thine heart be hasty to utter anything before God, for God is in heaven and thou upon earth. Therefore, let thy words be few. Taking on board the message of Ecclesiastes is a humbling experience, isn't it? It is a sobering thing. In terms of reminding us of that gulf that exists between God and ourselves. For a dream cometh through the multitude of business, and a fool's voice is known by the multitude of words. And we've all met people who won't shut up, haven't we? You know, and they just talk, and whether they're saying something sensible or something, you know, or they just keep talking, whether it's sensible or not. So you sort of imagine that kind of person and think, well, that's probably not how God wants us to be, really. You know, he wants us to be paying more attention to what he's doing and to what he's got to say. And verse 6, again, suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin, neither say thou before the angel that it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thy hands? Here now is another body part. For in the multitude of dreams and in many words there are also diverse vanities, but fear thou God. Now you remember that. Yeah, that's the conclusion of the whole matter, isn't it? That we should fear God and keep his commandments. And the preacher has himself got to that conclusion at this point when he thinks about how great God is and how small we are. So there's some good practical advice for living. But in terms of overall in the book, what is the preacher saying about how to live? Well, he's saying two things. And guess what? They contradict each other. Um, But that's entirely fitting now, isn't it? We can see that that's the case, that we live in tension between two things that are both, in a way, good principles. And we have to balance them out in our lives, don't we? And work out the right way. And it's that very exercise of applying our hearts to wisdom and thinking, what is the wise course for me and for my family, that spiritual character is deepened and developed. Now, there is a whole chain of passages which are fascinating, and the first one is in chapter 2 and verse 24. So this is one side of it. Chapter 2 and verse 24. Let's just look at where he finished before in verse 22. For what hath a man of his labor and of the vexation of his heart wherein he hath labored? Nothing. It's a zero-sum game. For all his days are sorrow and his travail grief. Yea, his heart taketh not rest in the night. This also is vanity. So you would think we would be depressed, wouldn't you, from that? But Solomon's essential message, or the preacher's essential message, is not, remarkably, a negative message. The thing that we take away, and that he comes back to and insists time and time again, is that having seen the vanity, and having learnt not to believe more about life and the pursuits of life than we should, you know, that life is not about golf, or any other thing that we might happen to be interested in, that the conclusion from that is not, what a relief, brothers, that we shouldn't play golf. It's quite different, isn't it? Look at verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw, that it is from the hand of God. So God allows us, and God gives us from his hand, the ability to enjoy some things in life. Now, ultimately, they're limited in all the kinds of ways that we've been considering, but nevertheless, there are some good things in life, and this is a gift from God. They didn't need to be, did they? God didn't owe us this. God has given us these things to enjoy. And we can enjoy them in an enlightened way, can't we? Because we're enlightened in the sense that we're no longer tricked into being consumed by those things, or we shouldn't be. We're no longer tricked into thinking that they're the answer. We know what they are. We know what their limits are. We know that they're nothing, ultimately. But God still allows us to enjoy them. And that's kind of him. And that's good of him to allow us to do that. And so we can enjoy them. And that's an appropriate thing. Let's look at a second one of these passages. Chapter 3 and verse 12. I know that there is no good in them. In these things, these various times and the time, things that we do when it's the appropriate time, I know that there is no good in them but for a man to rejoice and to do good in his life. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. That's a positive assertion, isn't it? So it's not that we look at all this stuff and we say, well, I'm just going to slip my wrists. His conclusion is the opposite of that. It's that we should live joyfully, but in recognition of the limits of those things. And he talks about eating and drinking. Now, it's one of the most enjoyable things in life, isn't it? To sit down with good company and good conversation and have a nice meal. You know, what a blessing that is, isn't it? Food might have been tasteless. You know, we might just have been given a pill, mightn't we, to swallow to get our nutrition. And God has allowed us this gift of being able to be hungry and to chew and to taste and to satisfy that hunger. And, you know, it's a vanity. It's one of those things that's going away. As we get towards the end of that stage, it might be, and it is for some, that they can't taste their food anymore. And that's so sad, isn't it? I remember an old sister saying to me that one time, you know, one of the saddest things is that I can't taste my food anymore. But at the moment, while we can taste it, let's rejoice and let's thank God for that wonderful gift that he's given us. Let's take another of these passages, chapter 5 and verse 18. Behold, that which I have seen, it is good and comely for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him. There it is again. This is a gift from God, for it is his portion. So God's given to each one of us an apportion then, an allotment. And that's, again, an economics term. Every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth and hath given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion and to rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. Now, it has no lasting value. There's nothing there that is going to go beyond the grave. There's nothing there that's going to save that man or guarantee him anything. But it is a gift from God that God has allowed him to enjoy. Verse 20, there's the contrast. For he shall not much remember the days of his life, because God answereth him in the joy of his heart. You know, it's not going. That's not the way to salvation. But it's still a gift that that man has been allowed to enjoy. So let's rejoice and enjoy the gifts that God has given us. This is the way to live then, not in depression about this vain life, but by learning the lessons from it and rejoicing in the good things that God has given us. So it's a complete misreading of the preacher when scholars or readers read it and take it as being, you know, all dull and pessimistic. The conclusion that the preacher draws is not a pessimistic conclusion. It's a conclusion of living joyfully and enjoying God's gifts, but recognizing their limitations. And that's what's hard to do, isn't it? Because the danger is that we get caught up and we forget the limitations and we worship those things instead of worshiping the Creator who gave them to us. Yeah. And that's what we've got to ensure that we don't do. And all these words about vanity are the reminder of that. Now, we've looked now at three of these passages. Now, this is quite a lot, isn't it? And, you know, we could continue like this, and there would be another four of them. There are seven of these passages in Ecclesiastes. This is like a rhythm, isn't it? This is something which is insistent through the book, that this is the way that we should live. And you say for a minute, well, is that scriptural? And people through the ages, you know, again, thinking about those 2,000 years worth of books that have been written on this, people are a bit uncomfortable about that. My own grandma was uncomfortable about it. So, you know, I was brought up in a pretty strict kind of way that, you know, riches were bad and that, you know, having material things was bad and that enjoying yourself was bad. The first time I ever talked about these passages, I think it was an exhortation in the Scarborough Ecclesia back years ago, and she talked to me afterwards and said, well, I can see what you're saying, but I'm not very comfortable. I'm not very comfortable about it because we're not here to enjoy ourselves. And of course, she was right, and these passages are right too, aren't they? They're intention, and we have to live with that tension and decide what is the better thing to do. And then if the choice comes between, well, I could enjoy myself and play golf all weekend and drink lots of glasses of wine and, you know, whatever it is that we might want to do, or I could actually go and have fellowship with my brothers and sisters, and I could, you know, teach my children about God's ways, and, you know, I could go and visit someone who's sick, and we're balancing those two things out, then it becomes clear, doesn't it, that we're going to balance that. And if we do go for our game of golf, then we do that, and we enjoy it, and then we get on with what's more important, because there are things that are more important than enjoying ourselves. And we've each got to work that out in our own lives, haven't we? And that's where we bring the rest of the scriptures in and say, it's not just about, is this okay? But it's also about, what's the best thing that I can do? But we should certainly rejoice in the good things that God has given us. I mean, some people were so uncomfortable with these passages, these eat and drink passages, that they've tried to argue that Solomon was being sarcastic. You keep chewing if you can. You know, I'm just going to spit my food out because I can't take it anymore because it's also, you know, the world is just so awful that we live in. If you can enjoy it, good for you. You go and enjoy yourself, but I can't enjoy it anymore. But I really just think that's a misreading of what the preacher is saying here. I don't think he's being sarcastic. I think these are genuine passages, and there are so many of them as well. And people have tried to allegorize it. People have tried to say, well, when he says eat and drink, he's actually talking about the bread and the wine. But again, you know, it's like it's trying too hard, isn't it? These are passages with, I think, a straightforward message. And it's a message that, you know, it's not like this is the only place this idea is referred to in the scriptures. I mean, it's more dominant here, perhaps, than anywhere else. And we remember, of course, that he is talking about this life in its own terms. And we know that there are other terms. You know, there's the next life to be preparing ourselves for. But, you know, you think of the passages that talk about God giving to all men life and breath and all things. And about God who has... God, this is 1 Timothy 6, verse 17. In fact, let's just go to that. Just keep finger in Ecclesiastes. Let's just look at 1 Timothy 6, because it's important. So this is the passage that Brother Simon quoted about greed, you know, when we're talking about the financial crisis. But tucked within there's something about enjoying the things that God has given us. God is the one who has made the sun to rise on the evil and the good, and who sends his rain on the just and the unjust, and we reap the benefits of those things, and it's right for us to enjoy them and to praise him for them. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 17 says, charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded, nor trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who giveth us richly all things to enjoy. So you see the connection there with Ecclesiastes. It says, God giveth us these things. He doesn't give us them stingily. He gives us them richly, and he gives us them to enjoy. And all those points are there in Ecclesiastes, aren't they? That this is the gift of God, that it's good for us to eat and to drink and enjoy the fruits of our labor. But you see, in the Timothy passage again, there's a tension, isn't there? Don't be tricked into thinking those things that you're enjoying are more than they are. They're just a vanity, an enjoyable vanity, but a vanity. That's all they are. Don't trust in them. Trust in God. And for all you might enjoy them, remember that there's a more important kind of riches. Spiritual riches are far more important. He goes on to talk about that in the next verse. Be rich in good works, not in bank accounts. That's more important. So you can see the balancing that's going on in that passage. Well, there's another four of these eat and drink passages, and we don't have time to turn them all up. But it's important again to stress that there are seven of these altogether. So this message is an insistent one, and it has been argued. I think it's quite interesting that as you go through them, the way in which each one is introduced gets a little bit stronger. So in the first one, there's no introduction. It's just there's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink. And then the second one, it says, I know that there's nothing better than. And the next one is, wherefore I perceive that there's nothing better. And then the next one is, behold that which I have seen. The next one is, so I praise joy. We've read the verse that tells us to rejoice in these things. And here's another verse that says, so I praise joy. There's nothing better than to eat and drink and to do those things. And let's look at the last two then, chapter 9 and verse 7. And this is, of course, in the chapter that's all about death, but right in the middle of that chapter, it says, go thy way. So this is an imperative now. Go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart. For God now accepteth thy works, let thy garments be always white, and let thy head lack no ointment. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity. So do you see again there? And you can see, yeah, there's something slightly ironic about that, isn't there? Enjoy it, but remember what it is. It's the life of your vanity. Yeah. Let's go to the final passage of these, and that's in chapter 11. Now, chapter 11, when we get to chapter 11, we're drawing to the end of the book, just like we're drawing to the end of this class and this series of classes. And you'll see that chapter 11 begins with one of those thou passages, where he turns to the camera and addresses us directly. So what advice has he got for us then? So we've been almost through all the observations that he's got about life. We've just got the big passage about impending decrepitude to come. And he comes up with this for us. Cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. So we could imagine that from his observations that we would say, well, I have no idea what time it is. You know, we talked about a time to sow and a time for this and a time for that. I've no idea what time it is. I've no idea what's going to happen. I'm only going to die anyway. I'm just going to sit down and wait until it happens, whatever it is. That's not his message. His message is the opposite of that, isn't it? His message is, go for it. Get out there and live. There's the making of many books. There's no end, but we've done enough considering now, and now it's time to go and to take the opportunities. Cast thy bread upon the waters. Take your opportunities and see what happens. The outcome might be good. Verse 2. Give a portion to 7 and also to 8, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. Again, you see how he's taking the glass half full approach here, isn't he? Rather than the glass half empty. You know, I don't know what's going to happen, therefore I'm going to do nothing. No, I don't know what's going to happen, therefore I'm going to be generous while I've got the opportunity. I'm going to enjoy the good things that God's given me, and I'm going to share them. I'm going to give a portion to 7 and to 8, so that someone else can rejoice as well as me. If the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth, and if the tree fall toward the north or toward the south, in the place where it falleth, there shall it lie. And that seems to be a point about, you know, there are consequences for things. If the clouds are full, then the consequence is it rains. If a tree falls, then it's, you know, if a tree sat there, it's because it fell down. There are consequences from things that happen. So therefore, do something good, and there might be a good consequence that comes from it. There might not be. It's a vain world, so it may be that nothing good does come of it, but the fact that it might means that you should go and take the opportunity. Verse 4, he that observeth the wind shall not sow, and he that regardeth the clouds shall not reap. So, you know, if we just sit there worrying about the weather forecast and say, well, I'm not going to do anything because the weather forecast might change and then I might not be able to do it, then that would be pretty stupid, wouldn't it? Don't be like that, he's saying. Get out there and get on with the work. Verse 6, in the morning sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thy hand, for thou knowest not whether shall prosper either this or that, or whether they both alike shall be good. So we don't know what's going to happen, but we believe in God, and we should take our opportunities while they present themselves to us. Truly, the light is sweet and it's a pleasant thing for the eyes to behold the sun. But if a man live many years and rejoice in them all, let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. All that cometh is vanity. So this again is about that tension, isn't it? About enjoying the good things while they're there, but also keeping in mind the limitations and what the future holds, where our eternal home is, without God's help and therefore living our life appropriately. The conclusion again in verse 9 is a conclusion to be joyful. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thy heart and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. So here is a positive, go out there and live and enjoy it. And then there's an offset to it that makes us, that's the check on how we live. Know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. So how shall we live? Well, we should live with two things in our view. One is that we should rejoice and enjoy the things that God has given us. It is a gift from him. But we shall also remember that we are vain creatures and life is a vain thing for a reason. We shall remember that there will be a judgment and God will bring to account all things for those who are responsible before him. So we shall want to think carefully about how we enjoy ourselves, won't we? And about the things with which we occupy ourselves in this life. But then having put that negative check in place, he then comes back to a positive. Therefore remove sorrow from thy heart and put away evil from thy flesh. For childhood and youth are vanity. And there's the negative again that offsets the positive. So we live then with those two things in our view. Chapter 12, that chapter about death. We've already made this point. You know, it's a downbeat chapter, isn't it? This decrepitude and this heading towards the long home of the grave. But the message from it is that we should rejoice before our Creator in the days that we have left towards us. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments. For that is what it's all about. That is every man. That's what should be the focus and the bottom line of our lives. We have to conclude with 1 Corinthians 15. There will be a time when God will remove those shackles that tie us to this earth. God will take away that impending decrepitude, that bondage of corruption to which we are chained. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, verse 53. And this mortal must put on immortality. So when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. And the two things, you remember chapter 1 and chapter 12, that bound the words of the preacher, that hemmed him in and that hems all of us in. Those things, those constraints will be taken away when God wipes away all tears from our eyes. And we know where he's going. He's going to that key word of Ecclesiastes, isn't he? That word, vanity. And he's telling us that because we have that hope for the future of a world when that warped world will be made straight and all things will be put right and made new and death will be swallowed up in victory. Because we know about that and because we have tied our lives to that hope instead of this life, then it is the case for us that we have already, in part, been redeemed from that bondage of corruption. We're still waiting for the redemption of our body, but in prospect, we've been redeemed from that bondage. Thanks be to God, which giveth us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as ye know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord.